other modalities. I think that Dr. Watson has shown very nicely. But what I want to talk about is this issue of communicating equipoise to patients and participants and enrolling them into studies. And then after that, we're going to get into a depiction of how you go about actually trying to enroll patients and how you address some of the more thorny issues of what patients may come into your office preferring. But first, just talking about, you know, how do we engage patients in the right way? Well, first of all, we all need to come to a consensus on what is the benefit of this study to our patients. So patients, what's the value proposition? And remember, if you're doing, for example, a study of a modality of drug or device that's not FDA approved, the patient can't get that modality or treatment without being on the study. So there's a very obvious benefit there. But for this type of study, where someone could really get any of these treatments we're talking about off study, why be in the study? Well, first of all, I think that the way you want to present this to the patient is, first of all, you know, a research study really is, in essence, a kind of quality improvement program, right? This is overall a program in which you're going to get close monitoring by an expert study team and a dedicated and caring and communicative coordinator. The treatment protocols that we use in the study are generally endorsed by an expert national group of investigators as well as the NIH. You're going to get free compression stockings provided by MedUSA, thankfully. And again, compression stockings, the out-of-pocket cost that patients have, it is a substantial barrier to use. There are two free ultrasound exams that you're getting. And at some sites, at our site, we don't charge patients for the follow-up visits that they have when they come in. So that's a good practice if one is able to engineer that in their own center. You're going to get stented if you get randomized to that, and you'll be stented in an environment where there is independent safety oversight. And if it turns out that stents don't work, it's better to have them done in this controlled kind of way, or to not get them overall. And ultimately, you're all going to be able to, even if you don't get the stents up front, you may be able to get them later if they're proven to work. And so this is an opportunity to help others while receiving excellent care. So we're not really selling the stents, we're selling the program, right? That's the important part about this. Now, it's important to just step back away from even the venous arena and consider what have we learned through the years about participant recruitment. There are people and scientists that devote their whole careers to studying what makes people choose to participate in studies in general. And here are the things that are important. This is both from data as well as from our own experiences. First and foremost, to a patient, your professionalism when you approach them, meaning your look and your demeanor, connote how trustworthy you are. You know, that's crucially important. I remember at one of our attract investigator meetings, we actually had a patient speak, and we asked the patient, you know, up front and said, well, why did you choose to get in the study? And the first thing the patient said is, when Patty approached me, she was so clearly so professional, you know, she was dressed appropriately, talked respectfully, etc., etc., and that was the thing that really hooked me at the very beginning. Now, when I say appropriate dress, what do I mean by that? Well, studies have shown that for overall, patients don't like white coats because it connotes the image of a lab researcher and a guinea pig from their perspective. Even though many of us think maybe that would make us look more credible, actually that's just the opposite on average. Patients are terrified of scrubs, and in this study I think that's very relevant, and in the ATTRACT trial others will tell you that in the middle of the trial, I did change my own clinical practice, and there was always a shirt and tie in my office, and before I would go and talk to patients, I would change into that shirt and tie to patients because I did not want to spoil, you know. Overall, it's been shown that suits are the best thing you can do. Now, we all don't work at the Mayo Clinic. We probably don't wear suits every day when we go to work. But nevertheless, actually for a male, the best possible dress is actually a suit. It improves recruitment rates in clinical studies, you know. And for women, a little bit less clearly defined in terms of strict kind of categories, but generally speaking, upscale professional dress is viewed by patients as being more credible. Overall, again, on average, people trust women a little bit more than they trust men. And in general, people tend to trust, you might not be surprised, people of a similar race or ethnicity, especially if that person visits twice, not once, you know. And so these are some general things just to keep in the back of your mind. I think the ones regarding dress, I think, are probably relevant. It helps, and it's been shown in studies to improve recruitment rates to orient the participant to what a research study is up front. This is important. Again, when you start, remember a lot of the patients, their health literacy is not what you may think it is. And while we talk about a study or a trial and all that, actually a lot of them don't really necessarily know what that really means, what it is. So when we start talking to the patient about the study, what we say is that something simple like research studies help doctors learn what treatments work best for their patients. Just something simple like that is an orienting statement that helps people understand what it is that you're doing, and it ties the research study to the quality of care, okay? In addition, mentioning the reputation of your institution also improves recruitment rates in clinical studies. So the way that we approach it when we first see a patient is something along the lines of, you know, here at Washington University, as you know, we have a strong commitment to providing outstanding quality care, and as part of that commitment, we engage in research studies that we believe are good for our patients. If you say it that way, you've really tied the study to the reputation of your institution and your commitment to quality patient care. And then at the end of your presentation, you want to recommend the study. A physician's recommendation to participate in the study absolutely increases recruitment rates, and it's one of the top things really that increases recruitment rates. So hopefully after these discussions, you'll be more comfortable with the equipoise, right? Because we all bring our own internal biases into this, and we'll feel comfortable suggesting to the patient that really the study is a great way to get great care and then also contribute to the care of others. With randomized trials, again, it's important, you know, we tend to focus on what's different, right? Stent versus non-stent, that's what's in our minds, right? But remember, most of the stuff that a patient gets in this clinical trial in this 2-year period of care is stuff that everyone's gonna get in the trial, not just the people that are stented, right? So medical therapy, compression, careful close monitoring, good communication, professional wound care for those who need it, everybody gets this stuff as part of the program. So really, you know, yes, you have to of course mention that you're gonna be randomized to stent or no stent, but that shouldn't be the dominant part of your presentation. It really should be focused around, this is part of a program to learn what works best for patients. Everyone's going to get these things that we know to be effective. The one thing we don't know if it works and that we're studying is the stenting itself. I think it's fine when patients sort of express a preference, we'll usually say something along, well, you know, it's understandable to think that, you know, one thing might be better. But remember that even experts around the country haven't agreed on what the better way to go is, right? And then again, this may require some work within your site because we all know that national equipoise doesn't necessarily translate to local equipoise, right? And so again, taking some of the things that you hear here and taking that out to your partners or your collaborators at your site would be very important to also get their buy-in so that if they happen to frame the discussion with the patient before you even get there, that they have the best chance of doing it in an effective way. Again, the things to remind them of that we don't know. We don't know if we can get the vein open. Most of the time we can, but some of the time we can't. We don't know if the stents are gonna stay open. We don't know how durable the benefit is. There are unknown and known determinants that may affect that degree of benefit in the long run. And again, if there are any issues with stents down the road, it's possible with devices that get on the market, this happens all the time, that some issues appear later that we didn't know about up front. I think in terms of engaging patients in general, it's also very important to keep in mind, and these are things that honestly, of course we all know these things in a sense, but in terms of living it in a daily life, I've learned from my research team quite a bit here. Looking at the patient as a person first is crucially important. You show interest in the whole person, and I've been there in front of our front desk, and I've been listening to Claire and Patty and Angela, you know, in the rooms talking to patients, and I'm hearing, oh, really? What kind of wedding do they have? Blah, 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 blah. And I'm thinking, okay, well, Patty's talking to her sister or some relative or whatever, and I find out. And then she'll get off the phone, she'll say, oh, well, that's patient number 002. You know, and I'll say, oh, really? And these things matter, okay? When a person says that they're actually interested in them as a person, that relationship obviously is strengthened, right? And you know, again, we're very busy people. We all know that these are not easy things always to do in the context of our busy lives, but they make a big difference in helping people be comfortable with you and your study team and being in a study, and with staying in the study in the long run and showing up for follow-up visits and going through that, right? There's also a lot that you can do to make the study easy for them to participate in, right? And it's really about following through. We talk a good game when we enroll them about, oh, we're gonna give you close monitoring and great follow-up and all that, but we need to follow through with that, right? They're choosing to take a risk to be in this study. And it's not just a simple like behavioral study. This is an interventional study where we're putting a permanent device in them, right? They deserve our commitments to really make sure that we are following through on that commitment. And so doing what we can to ease the schedule of their visits, to bring a wheelchair down to the, you know, to wherever they park, wherever the car comes in or the valet drives up or whatever it is, right? Getting them their timely reimbursement of their expenses for parking and all those kinds of things up front. You know, make the study easy to do and make it an easy thing. And really what you want is the patient to be thinking, helping the study is an easy thing to do. And you want their providers, who are gonna hear from the patients, to be thinking, yeah, this study is good for my patients, right? That's the ultimate goal of what you're after here, right? Okay, so I'll stop there. We're gonna have Patty come up and show how we go about getting patients into the studies. And I picked for her two very difficult personalities, of course, for her to deal with. The first patient is going to come up here, and Dr. Kali, and show us how it's done. Thank you.
So, Dr. Kali.
Oh, actually, I'm...
Can I call you Paula?
No, I'm Kush Akulesh Vedantam. I'm a 29-year-old patient who suffered a tragic power walking accident 3 years ago and got a lot of clot on my leg, and I've been suffering from leg swelling and pain since then.
So in our phone conversation, I got a lot of this from you, and I understand your disability is quite significant.
It's really terrible. I mean, I can't really get out of the house more than to get groceries every day. I'm really interested in anything I can do to make that better.
I understand. Well, we're glad that you're here. I work with a team of specialists who take care of patients with DVT, just like what you're dealing with. You know, there are a lot of treatments that we offer to patients that we know can help patients. There is, of course, anticoagulation therapy. Compression therapy is extremely important. There's various types of compression therapy. Okay, just not stockings, there's wraps, there's bandages, there's mechanical compression devices. In addition to that, there's, for our patients that have venous ulcers, we have a dedicated venous ulcer clinic. There is pain management, there's lymphedema care, and of course our hematology. We work very closely with our hematology team to make sure that you're on the most appropriate anticoagulation. So these are the therapies that we know for sure can help you. We also are involved in what we call endovascular therapy. Okay, that's where our doctors work. Access your vein with a tiny wire and catheter. We inject contrast dye, take pictures. We look with what we call venogram, and we also use IVUS, which means intravascular ultrasound. We can get even better pictures to look at your anatomy and see where your occlusion or narrowing is in the vein. After that, the doctor can prep the vein by inflating a tiny balloon to stretch the vein open. It's then deflated, taken out, and that way the vein is prepped for stent placement. And then we can place a stent. A stent is a permanent metal device. It's like a metal scaffold. It is a permanent device. It stays in the vein. It's there forever. So these are all of the therapies that we can offer you. We know the medical therapies can work on patients, okay? Our question is how effective the endovascular therapy is. We don't have long-term data. Our doctors have been placing stents for about 20 years. The stents that we were using were what we call off-label, so they were made for other parts of the body, not for the veins. In about the last year or so, we do have stents that were made for veins. We believe that those stents will perform better over time, but we don't have long-term data, okay? It's hard to know, okay, years down the line, how your body is going to react to the stent and what the long-term effects are going to be. Right now, we know that there is a 60 to 80% 1 to 2 year patency with those stents. We know that in 4 to 5 years after stent placement, about 40% of patients have to have the stent, what I call tuned up. Okay, so sometimes the stent can narrow over time. And we go back in with a balloon and do balloon angioplasty to open it up. In some situations, the stent can completely occlude. And it's a little more challenging in those situations. Our doctors can do it, but it is a challenging situation. So the good news for you is that you're here, you're with us. I work with a team of experts. And there's an exciting opportunity that is available for you to participate in a study where we actually look at giving all the patients, providing medical therapy to all the patients, okay? And it's a very structured, organized program that our patients enter, where we leverage each therapy, okay, in a very systematic way. Half all of the patients in the study get medical therapy. Half of the study is randomized to get endovascular therapy. It's randomized because that's where our question is. We don't know how effective endovascular therapy will be for those patients. We know with great certainty that medical therapy is effective. We're not doing studies on medical therapy. We know that. That's been established. But the question does lie with endovascular therapy. Patients are followed for 2 years, should you decide to enroll. Everything that we offer on study in terms of treatments is also offered off study. Okay? I want to make sure you understand that. But on study, it's, again, a very structured program. We follow you very closely, initially at 2 months, 4 months, and 6 months, and then we spread it out a little bit more to 12, 18, and 24. We provide free compression stockings at every visit. You will get ultrasounds at baseline and at 6 months. You will see me and the doctor at every visit. Your follow-up visits are free. Nothing is charged to you in terms of follow-up. Patients that are randomized to endovascular therapy, it is, again, considered standard care. And so that service would be charged to you or your insurance company. Everything else on the study is provided. After each follow-up visit, patients are provided a $100 stipend for your time and effort. Okay? I said a lot. Do you have any questions at this point?
That was really... Well, you told me a lot. Thank you so much. That was so thorough. I have some questions. You know, it's funny, I've been having this problem for 3 years, and it's the first time I've ever heard of, what did you call it?
Endovascular therapy. we actually go in the vein.
Yeah, and then this is sort of part of a research study. I mean, I kind of feel like, would I be being experimented on being part of this study?
So that's a good question. I hear that a lot. But everything that we do on study is also offered off study. These are standard of care treatments. Our study is what we call, in fancy terms, a comparative effectiveness study. We're comparing, two treatments. We're comparing standard optimal medical therapy against standard optimal medical therapy in combination with endovascular therapy.
Somebody else
started. I see. So maybe my other doctors just didn't know about this type of therapy.
Many doctors don't. If you're not in this particular specialty, many doctors are used to conventional therapy, anticoagulation, basically. Some patients are offered compression, but many aren't. And even when it comes to the medical therapies, they're not optimized in the way we can do it, okay?
That makes sense. The other thing, I'm really anxious about medical procedures. I mean, it seems like it might be dangerous to cut me open. But did you say it was stretching the vein, mm-hmm. putting a metal something in there?
Mm-hmm. So let me be clear. This is a minimally invasive procedure, okay? Should you be randomized to the endovascular therapy. We do everything through tiny skin narrows. our procedures are done through tiny skin nicks. Okay, so in the vein, in the a neck vein, the doctor can access, possibly a vein in the groin. What we do, we can give you most of the time we use moderate sedation. Okay, there's a dedicated nurse in the room giving you pain medications and medicines to relax you. Most of the discomfort comes after the procedure, and it's very limited. So when the physician goes to put the stent in and does the angioplasty, from stretching the vein open, it's very, very common to have discomfort for a day or two afterwards. Sometimes it can last up to a week. Sometimes you can have a little bit of neck discomfort at the access site or the groin. It's a very limited amount of time. And if patients can tolerate ibuprofen, that's usually what we recommend. It's inflammatory pain is what you're having, and that usually takes care of things. But very, very common to have some pelvic, back, maybe hip discomfort afterwards. It does get better. I tell patients it's almost like putting on a new pair of shoes. You kind of have to, break them in a little bit.
Okay. And should I be worried about having something permanent in my body? A friend of mine had something called a filter place, and we looked it up, and there are all kinds of lawsuits out there. I'm 29. Concerned about, should I really have something permanent in my body?
Yeah. So that's a great question. A stent is a permanent device. It is in forever. As I described, it's like a metal scaffold. It actually grows into the side of the vein. And the whole idea is to keep that vein propped open, okay? In some situations, rare situations, we have heard of stents fracturing, stents moving or migrating. It's highly unlikely. I've been doing this 12 years now. I've not personally seen a situation like that. It has happened. With our newer stents, the likelihood of that happening is much less. Yes, permanent device. Our doctors, when they put it in, they after the stent placement, they do balloon inside the stent to adhere it, make adhere to the main wall as much as they can to help it prevent evaporation.
So there's no way to take it out if it doesn't work?
I'm not going to say there's no way to take it out. It can be surgically removed, but that usually is not unless there's some compelling reason that it needs to come out. It's permanent.
Seems reasonable. How about afterwards? You know, I'd really like to get back to my power walking career. Mm-hmm. Would there be restrictions with this metal stent in there? Can I do that?
You know, walking is good. We want you to walk. We definitely don't want you laying around afterwards. But what we suggest is that you gradually step it up. Okay, you're going to be a little achy afterwards. Like I said, for a day or two, you know, the stent is incorporating itself into the vein. So we don't want any strenuous activity, heavy lifting, that kind of thing. The activity that you're describing is good, as long as you slowly step it up. I usually recommend no heavy lifting or strenuous activity for about a month after stent placement.
Okay, well that seems like it would be better than what I'm doing now. And the other thing I was worried about is, you mentioned that some people have to come back and get them touched up. I mean, if I start down this path, am I sort of starting on a path of always having to come back and have procedures done?
So it's not true for every patient. There are, like I said, about 40% of our patients after 4 years that we see, 4 to 5 years come back needing some balloon angioplasty. It doesn't happen to everyone. It certainly can happen. With our newer stents, we were expecting them to perform better. But we don't have long-term data on that. We've been using them about a year, the newer ones. So we'll have to see.
Well, it's a lot to think about. I guess my question is, if I was your brother, would you recommend that I participate in this trial?
I absolutely would. We don't have a clear answer as to how to best proceed. You know, again, we know that good medical therapy, I've seen patients improve on good medical therapy. Many, many, many times. And
I can't be in the trial and just not get stented. Can I just choose to not get stented and be in the trial?
It's a randomized study. So the one thing I do want you to remember is that the only thing different about the whole study is what happens up front, okay? If you get stented, you get the endovascular procedure. Your follow-up is all the same. Everybody else in the study would get. You know, if you have strong feelings, either way, I can't really enroll you in this study. You would be treated off protocol, which is certainly your option. But I think there's a lot of benefits that we can afford you by participating.
I understand. Thank you for explaining all that. I'm ready to sign up.
Thank you, Dr. And I talked to you a little bit about a great opportunity that we have going on here. Our goal with the study that I talked to you about is to do our very best to, you know, reduce your disability, improve your quality of life and your symptoms, and to see if the question that we're trying to answer is if endovascular therapy is the best option for patients with chronic post-thrombotic syndrome.
I've been struggling for a while. I 10 years ago, I had this injury while I was skiing, and then I had to not move around for a couple days while my family skied, and then when I got home, after flying home, my leg was really swollen. And you know, it's been swelling, it's been getting worse. can't be as active as I used to be. I have young kids at home. I really want to walk around and follow them around and do activities with them. And I can't do any of that.
So I'm curious, what medical therapies are you following? What are you on at this point?
Yeah, I tried, you know, they've given me socks. And, you know, I had those tight white socks on. And I was wearing them as much as I could. But I really just couldn't walk around. I couldn't move around. And wasn't getting any better. It just hurts. Mm-hmm. Every time I stand up after about 10, 15 minutes, I can't do it.
Okay. I'm curious about the socks. Medically graded socks? Were you professionally fitted?
I don't know. You know, some doctor gave me a prescription for it. I'm not sure which socks they gave me, but they were tight.
They were tight. You just could not tolerate them. Okay. All right. And you're on anticoagulation blood thinning medicines?
I've been taking my blood thinners, you know, consistently for all this time. Maybe some gaps here and there, but for the most part, I take them.
Okay. And do you see a hematologist?
I did at some point, but I stopped a few years ago. They weren't really doing much for me.
Okay. So we talked about this on the phone, but let me just reiterate, you know, on our study, there are several medical therapies that we can offer. Okay, hematology is very, very important. I think it might be good to have your anticoagulation regimen reevaluated. Compression therapy, very, very important. There's different types of compression besides the socks that you're wearing. Okay, there's different degrees of compression. There's besides the stockings, there's wraps, there's bandages, there's mechanical compression devices. I think we can find something that is suitable for you, okay?
My doctor who sent me over though said there's something about stenting my vein open, and that would be the thing that would help me.
Okay, so in addition to the medical therapies, and there are more, that is the other type of therapy, endovascular therapy. We actually go in the vein, look at it, take some pictures, use intravascular ultrasound to get even more detailed pictures, put a balloon in, inflate a balloon, stretch the vein open, and prepare it for stent placement. That is the therapy where the jury is kind of still out. We don't have good data, long-term data, to show how effective that therapy is. So I can't tell you with certainty that you are going to get better, okay? Some patients, you can include the stents. If that happens, it's very, very difficult to get open. The stents can narrow over time. It's a metal device that's in your body forever. We don't have long-term data as to how that stent is going to behave over time. We've been using stents off-label for about 20 years. Many of our patients do fine. There are many of our patients that they develop a stent occlusion. Like I said, it can be extremely challenging to get open, and their symptoms could be worse after that than they were to begin with. It's hard for us to know who's going to do well and who's not going to do so well.
Yeah, but the stents are going to open my vein, right?
The intention is for the stent to open your vein. The challenge is then to keep that vein open. And we can do that. Blood thinning medicines, antiplatelet drugs. We will do our best. We will optimize all of that, but it is still no guarantee that stent will stay open. And again, we don't have long-term data to know how you will do years from now. That stent.
Yeah. I'm getting tired of doing all these blood thinners. And, yeah. You know, can I just get the stent and have my vein open, and I don't need to take those anymore?
You can certainly. You know, if you don't want to participate in the study, that's certainly your option. It is provided as standard care, as all of the medical therapies are that we offer. If it were me, my family member, I think it's in their best interest to at least explore the medical options, optimize those to the extent possible. You have a chronic condition. Stent placement can always be reevaluated in time, especially if the study still shows that this is an effective, the most effective treatment for our patients. I know it's a hard condition to live with.
Yeah, no, it's really tough. I want to get back out there and be able to
really get it.
Do activity and really get this fixed.
But I think once we start optimizing the medical therapies again, I think you're going to, I'm certain that you're going to see some improvement. Because I think where you've been so far, there's not a whole lot's been done. Anticoagulation, stockings that you don't really like, there's other things that we can do. There's, you know, I didn't mention venoactive medications. We can certainly give those a trial. Pain management.
Sounds like it would be a good team with a lot of options. You know, I guess it can help some people potentially better understand what I'm suffering with too.
And many patients take that stand, which is admirable. You would be helping so many other patients out there by helping doctors figure out a way.